Hello. This morning we take a walk through the annual student exhibition at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts and speak with the show's coordinator and some collectors at opening night, keen to own works by some of the region's most promising young artists. Jason Pfeiffer visits the Cirque du Soleil Village in Philadelphia as the Quebec-based company stages its latest touring work, Kusa. And Susan Lewis considers the 18th century German Baroque composer Georg Philipp Telemann, said to be the most prolific composer in music history. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Student art exhibitions have long signified the end of the college career and hopefully the start of a long and fruitful professional career. The nation's oldest art school and museum, the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, has been showcasing the art of graduating students for over a century, and this week, once again, begins exhibiting works by senior certificate and master's students. These works are also for sale, and as we'll learn, are in high demand. Earlier this week, I took a walk through the exhibition with coordinator Jill Kaplinski. Even in the space we're standing in, there's a great variety of works. Are there segments dedicated to specific students? Is that how it works? They get a piece of wall space?
That's right. Traditionally, the certificate students, because they are so numerous, and we have to put so many into this space, they hang in what we call a salon style. The paintings are stacked from floor to ceiling. And some students take great advantage of the fact that they are on 18-foot-high walls, and some of the walls are 9 feet wide. The largest, I believe, is 15 feet wide. No, 20, actually, in the hallway. So that's a phenomenal amount of square footage for those students in that space.
I notice you're called the coordinator and not the curator or the moderator, so they have a free hand. There's no editing process here.
That's absolutely right. My job is to help them find a space appropriate for their work and kind of massage that process along through the months that they're creating their work in their last year. I help them get their space together. I work with the establishment of the walls and putting that together with contractors. And then it's up to the students to actually put the work in that space.
The great fantasy of these graduate exhibitions is that you can be struck by lightning, that the great private collector or the institutional collector will come in and have a eureka moment in front mm-hmm. of your work. Is that a myth or does it happen?
Oh, no, it's absolutely true. It happened to me because I went to school here. I was collected by someone who's very big in the Philadelphia art scene, and I say to the students, it's a very important time for you to put your work together in a professional manner because you will be selected for someone's collection. Your work, that is. It's also a very trying situation because they may never sell at the prices that they sell here because people really want to buy the student work. They really want to support the students. And we have a preview party. We have the women's board of the academy brings in folks from all over the area to look at this work, to support it through the sales, and the proceeds go mostly to the students.
And then institution collectors, because yeah. A lot of the time we find institutions with great holes in their collections, mm-hmm. and if only they'd been in there at the ground floor, they could have had a Jasper Johns for $500
Absolutely.
50 mm-hmm. years ago.
Sure, we hear that all the time about our annual exhibitions where we had an opportunity to buy, I think it was a Jackson Pollock, and at a very low price. But and that happens with students' work. And we have students who will actually be showing in major galleries in a very short time.
I've heard this from somebody not at this school, that he would have his major donors calling him and saying, before you let anybody else in there, I want you to walk me through and help me find something. I'm guessing you get that kind of pressure as well from people saying, help me pick something out.
We absolutely do, and we absolutely don't allow that.
Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts annual student exhibition coordinator Jill Kaplinski. We've now moved out of the galleries and into the lobby of the Samuel M.V. Hamilton building, and it's a few minutes before the opening of a fundraising preview of the show. Here there are dozens of people who have paid as much as $1,500, I believe, for the privilege of being among the first to see and have the option to buy art from this exhibition.
My name is David Rubin.
And my name is Jamie O'Neill.
This is one of our favorite annual events to come to the student exhibition of the Pennsylvania Academy. It is an incredibly worthwhile event, but it's also very exciting because you get to see the work of so many young, vibrant artists that are graduating from the Academy.
And are you here to buy?
We're always in the market. It's very exciting to be here at the starting time. I have to very soon get in position so that I can start blocking others from getting in.
And do you have a strategy then for, are you throwing women and children behind you as you run through?
Well, we have actually had opportunities where we've had to, nudge with the elbows to try to get through in a timely fashion.
But we've actually had the women and children try to throw us, which has been a little disappointing.
Hello, I'm Leanne Shively. I go for color and what I like. Yeah, if it speaks to me, I go for it, because the prices are pretty good. It's a really nice way to buy art. I bought one of the prize winners last year. I was here early, like I am today. She won the Landscape Award, and she was a sophomore. Very, very, very nice piece of work. But I couldn't get it home. So big.
Some art aficionados hoping to add to their collections earlier this week. The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts 107th Annual Student Exhibition opens to the public today and runs through June 1st at the Samuel M.V. Hamilton Building on North Broad Street in Philadelphia.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
German Baroque composer Georg Philipp Telemann reportedly wrote more music than any other composer in history, and during his lifetime he was wildly popular. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at the life, music and mystery of this 18th century master, whose works are being performed over the next week in concerts by two Philadelphia area ensembles.
I associate Telemann with his own unique balance of melody and virtuosity.
He wants to try everything that's possible musically, and so he became a master of every conceivable musical style.
He's absolutely a musician's composer.
For sure, musicians like Alyssa Berardi and Bruce Becker, co-artistic directors of Philomel Baroque Ensemble, and flutist Mimi Stillman, artistic director of Dolce Suono Chamber Music Series, know and love the music of Georg Philipp Telemann. Yet his name doesn't have that household ring to it, like Bach or even Handel, both of whom were his contemporaries.
There's a long tradition of denigrating Telemann's music, partly because scholars in the 19th century put Telemann down so they could raise Bach up.
Stephen Zohn is associate professor of music history at Temple University and author of a new book on Telemann's instrumental works. He says Telemann's popularity worked against him with musical historians.
People say, there's this mass of music that we don't have a real handle on, and how could it be very good?
Telemann's rise to musical power was also against the odds. He was born in 1681 into a family of Lutheran clergymen who were not at all eager to see Georg pursue a career in music. Instead, he was encouraged to study law, which didn't hold his attention very long once he got to Leipzig University. There, says Bruce Becker, he had opportunities to engage his self-taught passion.
He kept dabbling in music, and finally the floodgates just broke, and he became a composer.
And did he ever! He founded his own semi-professional orchestra. He took a series of court positions in Poland and Germany, was city music director of Frankfurt and then Hamburg. By the time Telemann died at the age of 86, he had composed around 3,600 works spanning every genre, from choral works and oratorios to chamber music, concertos, orchestral suites, passions, and operas. Stephen Zohn says Telemann not only wrote a mind-boggling amount of music, he published his works himself.
He actually physically engraved it himself, paid to have it printed, distributed it to publishing agents all across Europe.
He was great at marketing. I think of him as the pop star of the Baroque era.
Alyssa Berardi says the historically accurate instruments on which Philomel plays are especially good at illustrating Telemann's mastery of the Baroque musical conversation.
A fascinating little gem is the trio in F major for recorder, viola da gamba, and continuo.
In writing for his diverse audiences of both amateur and professional musicians, Telemann incorporated influences from other parts of Europe as well. Flutist Mimi Stillman says Telemann developed a style known as German mixed tastes,
which is a blend of styles, German contrapuntal techniques with French and Italian styles, and even with Polish styles.
Rich with cross-cultural influences, the music also combines emotion and technique, says Stillman, pointing to the suite for flute and strings in A minor.
Not only is it happy, but it's very virtuosic for the flute. Today, Telemann still occupies a back seat to his contemporaries, Handel, and especially Bach, who has emerged from history as an icon, celebrated in festivals and played, copied, and adapted in multiple genres. But perhaps Telemann's time is coming. With a new book about him and opportunities to hear him around the corner, more and more people may be taking another look at this 18th century musical sensation.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Philomel Baroque's concerts of the music of Telemann, Bach and Vivaldi take place this evening at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Doylestown and on Sunday evening at the Church of St. Martin in the Fields in Chestnut Hill. On Wednesday, Dolce Suono performed Telemann's Suite for Flute and Strings in A Minor along with music of Bach and Handel at the First Unitarian Church on Chestnut Street in Philadelphia. And Stephen Zone's new book on Telemann is called Music for a Mixed Taste, Style, Genre and Meaning in Telemann's Instrumental Works. It's published by Oxford Press. Circuses, in one form or another, have been around since ancient Roman times, and with so many circus shows on tour throughout the world today, it's clear that high-wire acts, clowning, and the all-encompassing spectacle that is the circus can still draw large, enthusiastic crowds. One especially popular group is now back in Philadelphia, and since WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer once dreamed of running away to join a circus, we thought we should, at least temporarily, give him a chance to live out his dream.
There's something magical and compelling about the circus. The physical feats and the slapstick humor can be mesmerizing. Children fantasize about being part of this. I, for one, always wanted to be a lion tamer. But while there are no lions, elephants, or tigers in Cirque du Soleil, such enchantment with the circus, among adults and children alike, might help explain the explosive growth of the Canadian company. Cirque du Soleil, which means Circus of the Sun, was started in 1984 with a group of 20 street performers in Quebec. It's now made up of 4,000 employees from 40 different countries. This year alone, the company will have staged 18 shows, some in resident theaters around the world, like the Las Vegas production Love, made in collaboration with and using the music of the Beatles, and other shows are on the road. The latest Cirque show to come to Philadelphia is Cusa. It's not the first visit from the Montreal-based group. Hidam, Alegria, Dreleon, and Varique have all passed through. But Cusa is the newest of Cirque's touring productions, and it's a large undertaking. 50 tractor trailers worth of show materials and equipment, which with the help of local laborers and over 100 Cirque du Soleil employees, takes 8 days to unpack and set up. One of the first things that's set up is the 80-foot-tall big top tent, which holds over 2,500 people.
The official name is the Grand Chapiteau.
Director of Tour Services, Peter DeBay, says though it's a lot of work to set up and tear down the temporary structure in each town, it's at the very heart of the circus show.
This show has a very specific set, as do all of our shows. So when we already have a structure that we know how it's going to work, we don't have to search all the theaters and arenas to fit it in. And it's a total experience. You know, you walk into the big top where you have this immense spectacle of a show that a lot of times you don't expect in a big top.
With a live band, 9 acts and 53 performers, Cusa, which means box or treasure, is a return to the origins of Cirque du Soleil, focusing on the circus traditions of acrobatics and clowning. There's juggling, a high wire act, a flying trapeze, unicycle, and a wheel of death. Justin Sullivan, who's been with Cirque du Soleil for 7 years, plays one of the main characters in the show, the trickster.
The creator, David Schreiner, is a clown, and this show has a lot of clowning elements. It also has a very developed storyline that I think is easy to follow. All the Cirque shows have an underlying storyline, but I think some are a little more abstract. And this show, I think, with the trickster and innocent characters, the two main characters in the show, you really get a sense of what's happening straight away. You've got this little innocent guy and this scary trickster character that's trying to show him the ways of the world.
The show starts with Sullivan as the trickster, springing out of a box onto the stage, demonstrating his acrobatic skills. Before his Cirque du Soleil days, the Texas native competed around the country as a trampolinist and tumbler. Sullivan says while he never fully enjoyed the pressure of competition, he can't imagine his life without acrobatics. So Cirque is an excellent fit for him.
It gave me a chance to do what I love without having to deal with all the competing and having to please people. I got to do what I love every night in front of an audience that loved what we were doing, and you really feed off of that energy when you do something great on stage and the audience loves it.
Any Cirque du Soleil show is full of spectacle. But there's more to a traveling show like Cusa than innovative entertainment and the big top tent. There's an entire village of tents. Tents for rehearsal, technical services, physical therapy, a school for the children traveling with the show, and a kitchen with three chefs that serves 300 meals a day.
It is literally like a gigantic traveling town with a family within it. So because it's the same environment in each city, you have that little sense of home on tour. I think that helps with people feeling homesick or alienated when you come to a new city. The only thing that really changes is the environment around you. Everything within the Cirque is exactly the same from city to city.
Life in the Cirque Village and on the road isn't always glamorous and easy, according to Director of Tour Services Peter DeBay. But it nonetheless holds a strong appeal for some people.
There's something about touring life. If it's in your blood, it's in your blood. So it's hard to imagine leaving. There's a saying, you never really leave Cirque. A lot of people that leave come back in a few years.
That report was by WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer, who we're happy to report is keeping his day job. Cirque du Soleil's Cusa is in Philadelphia at Broad Street and Washington Avenue through June 15th. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Gigi Lam and Cara Morganti. You can find past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.